Hey everyone, and welcome to another deep dive. This time we're going to be looking at some early biblical history and what archaeology can tell us about it.
Oh, very cool.
So our source material is a lecture transcript from a biblical archaeology course focusing on Genesis chapters 1 through 11.
Okay.
So we're going to be talking about things like the Garden of Eden, Noah's Ark, the Tower of Babel, all kinds of really interesting stuff that's in those first 11 chapters of Genesis.
I'm excited.
Yeah, me too. So to get us started, I was really struck by this description of a Sumerian cylinder seal that dates to about 2200 BC.
Okay.
And it depicts two figures seated in front of a tree with serpents standing behind them. Does that sound familiar to you?
Yeah, like Adam and Eve.
Exactly. Mm. It really seems to echo that story of the fall of man from Genesis.
Yeah, and that's really interesting because that predates the traditional timeline for Adam and Eve.
Right.
So it makes you wonder if maybe there was a... a shared memory or some kind of oral tradition even that predates the written account that we have in Genesis. It's like these ancient cultures had their own versions or interpretations of these events.
Exactly.
Yeah, that's super interesting. Okay, so let's jump from a mysterious seal to a mysterious building.
Okay.
Have you ever heard of the Chalcolithic Temple at Engedi?
I have. It's a really fascinating site. It's this isolated temple overlooking the Dead Sea.
Yeah, it's from the Chalcolithic period, which is basically the Copper Age.
Right.
And one of the things that really caught my attention was the description of this donut-shaped basin in the courtyard.
Oh, yeah, I've seen pictures of that.
So what do you think that was all about?
Well, some scholars believe that it might have housed a sacred tree.
Really? A tree?
Yeah, it might seem odd to us, but tree worship was actually pretty common in ancient cultures.
Uh-huh.
You know, trees, they provide food, shelter, even medicine.
Right.
They're seen as these powerful symbols of life, fertility.
Yeah, that makes sense. And, you know, it makes me think about those stories in the Bible about the Israelites worshiping trees and poles, like the Asherah poles.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating to see how certain symbols and rituals like tree worship pop up in different cultures throughout history.
It really makes you wonder about the origins of religion and those deep-seated human impulses that drive us to connect with something bigger than ourselves.
For sure.
Okay, so we've talked about the fall and mysterious temples now. Let's get to maybe the most famous location in Genesis, the Garden of Eden.
Okay.
So where on earth was paradise?
Well, that's a question that has puzzled people for centuries.
I bet.
Genesis gives us a few clues. It mentions four rivers flowing out of Eden, two of which we know today, the Tigris and the Euphrates.
Right.
But finding the other two, the Pishon and the Gihon, has been a real challenge.
So where are some of the places that people have theorized that the Garden of Eden might have been?
Well, one possibility is northern Iraq and western Iran, an area that's rich in place names that seem to connect back to Eden.
Okay.
Another theory focuses on this massive dried-up riverbed
that
stretches across Saudi Arabia. Scientists call it the Kuwaiti River. And some believe it could be the Pishon mentioned in Genesis.
That would have been an incredible sight to see. A river that size flowing through a lush garden.
It really brings those stories to life, doesn't it?
It does.
And it highlights how much we still don't know about the ancient world.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so from a garden paradise, let's move on to a catastrophic flood. The story of Noah's Ark.
Right.
Now, I know that flood myths are not unique to the Bible.
That's right.
What's the deal with that?
Well, it's interesting. Flood narratives appear in cultures all over the world, which suggests that maybe there's some kind of shared memory of a devastating flood event in our distant past.
Mm.
For example, the Epic of Gilgamesh from ancient Babylonia has some really striking parallels with the Noah story.
Really? Like what?
Well, you had this massive flood, a chosen survivor animals being rescued on a boat.
Wow.
But what sets the biblical account apart is its theological emphasis.
Okay, so what do you mean by that?
Well, the ark, having only one entrance, symbolizes Christ as the sole way to salvation. This focus on one God and one path to redemption is central to Christian theology and sets it apart from other flood narratives.
So it's not just about the flood itself, but what it represents on a spiritual level.
Exactly.
But has anyone actually found Noah's Ark? I feel like I've heard stories about people claiming to have found it.
There have been many claims and expeditions over the years, but so far, no conclusive proof has emerged. But some researchers, like those from Andrews University, are still actively searching around Mount Ararat in Turkey.
Okay.
They believe that if the ark landed high up on the mountain, the conditions might have preserved it.
Wow. It's amazing how a story this old can still capture our imagination and inspire exploration.
It really is.
Okay, so if we assume for a moment that there was a major flood event, the next question is, when did it happen?
Right.
Can we pin it down to a specific time period?
Well, dating ancient events, especially those from prehistoric periods, is a real challenge. But some researchers believe that the flood could have occurred during the Neolithic period, sometime before 4300 BC.
Okay, and why the Neolithic? What's the connection there?
Well, during the Neolithic, we see this sudden disappearance of certain cultures, mm-hmm. and then the emergence of new, distinct cultures.
Mm.
So imagine this. A cataclysmic flood wipes out settlements, disrupts trade routes, forces people to adapt and rebuild in new ways. It's possible that the flood, or at least its aftermath, could help explain this transition.
Wow, so we're talking about a potential reset button on human history.
In a way, yes.
But we need to be careful about drawing direct connections without solid evidence. Right?
Absolutely. We're dealing with a lot of unknowns here, and interpreting archaeological evidence is a complex process.
Right.
There are always multiple interpretations, and we should approach these theories with a healthy dose of skepticism.
Agreed. Okay, so no definitive answers on the flood's date, but plenty of food for thought. Now I want to talk about a discovery that sounds like something straight out of an Indiana Jones movie. A cave packed with copper treasures from the Chalcolithic period.
Oh yeah, you're talking about the Nahal Mishmar cave.
Yes.
It's in the Judean wilderness. It was discovered back in the 1960s, and it was like a time capsule full of beautifully crafted copper artifacts, mm-hmm. scepters, crowns, maces, all perfectly preserved.
It sounds incredible.
It really is.
And here's where things get really interesting. Both the Nahal Mishmar cave and that enigmatic Chalcolithic temple at En-Gedi were abruptly abandoned. It's like those people vanish into thin air, leaving their treasures behind.
It's a mystery that has baffled archaeologists for decades.
So what are some of the theories about why they might have left so suddenly?
Well, some scholars believe that a sudden climate shift might have made their settlements unsustainable.
Okay.
Imagine a prolonged drought that dried up their water sources, or a shift in weather patterns that impacted their crops.
Right. Without the technology to adapt, they might have had no choice but to abandon their homes. It makes you wonder if there are other lost settlements out there buried beneath the sands of time, just waiting to be rediscovered.
I'm sure there are. Archaeology is all about uncovering those hidden chapters of human history.
Yeah.
And there are still so many mysteries to solve.
Okay, I'm ready to tackle another big one. The Tower of Babel and the origin of languages.
Right.
You know, I've always loved the humor in that story. Humanity trying to reach heaven with a giant tower and God saying, nope, not today.
It's a story that has captivated people for centuries.
Oh, sure.
On one level, it's a funny tale about human ambition and overreaching. But on another level, it grapples with these profound questions about communication, understanding, and the diversity of cultures.
And the fact that it takes place in Babylon, literally meaning gate of God, adds another layer of irony, doesn't it?
It does.
It's like they were trying to force their way into heaven, and instead their efforts led to confusion and separation.
Yeah, and it makes you think about the development of languages itself.
It's mind-blowing, right?
Yeah, it is. How did we go from grunts and gestures to this incredible tapestry of languages we had today? It's still one of the biggest mysteries in science.
And, you know, I've always imagined the Tower of Babel looking something like those ziggurats, those massive stepped pyramids with temples on top that were so common in ancient Mesopotamia.
I can see that.
This massive structure reaching for the sky, a testament to human ingenuity and ambition.
There's definitely a visual connection there.
Yeah.
And it's interesting to think about how ancient rulers like Nebuchadnezzar would stamp their names on the bricks of these structures, almost as if they were trying to leave their mark on eternity.
And isn't it funny how even today we have leaders like Saddam Hussein who restored some of those ancient sites and put their own names on the bricks?
Yeah, it's like that desire to leave a legacy, to make a mark on the world, is a timeless human impulse.
Totally. Okay, before we wrap up this part of our deep dive, we have to talk about the Sumerian king lists. These lists record these crazy long lifespans for kings, particularly those who reigned before and after a major flood. What's the deal with that? Does this tie in with the long lifespans described in the biblical genealogies?
That's a great question. And you're right, there are definitely parallels between the Sumerian king lists and the biblical accounts, particularly in Genesis 5.
Okay.
Both describe lifespans that seem almost impossible by today's standards. hundreds, even thousands of years in some cases.
I remember reading about Methuselah, who supposedly lived to be 969 years old. Was he really that old, or is there something else going on here?
It's a question that has puzzled scholars for centuries. Some argue that these ancient texts might be using hyperbole or symbolism.
Okay, so maybe they weren't literally living for hundreds of years, but what were they trying to convey?
Perhaps they were using longevity as a way to express the importance and significance of these figures. You know, a long life could represent wisdom, power, or even a closer connection to the divine. It's a way of elevating these individuals to a legendary status.
I see. So it's not just about the literal years, but what those years represent in the context of those ancient cultures.
Exactly.
That makes sense. And it's worth noting that the biblical genealogies show a gradual decrease in lifespans after the fall. By the time we get to Abraham, lifespans are more in line with what we would consider normal today.
Right. It's like a gradual return to a more human scale.
Yeah. A slow descent from those mythic, larger-than-life figures of the past. This is all so fascinating.
It really is. And it's just the tip of the iceberg when it comes to exploring the connections between biblical history, archaeology, and ancient texts.
I can't wait to dive in further.
Me too. Yeah. It really does make you think about all the connections.
Yeah, for sure. Okay, so we've talked about long lifespans now. I'm curious about these abandoned settlements that we've been discussing. What about those folks from the Chalcolithic period? Any theories about what might have happened to them?
Well, it's a puzzle, isn't it? You have these incredible copper treasures hidden away in a cave. Then you have this whole settlement in En-Gedi that's just abandoned.
Yeah, what could have been so disruptive that they just walked away from their lives and left all their stuff behind?
Almost like they knew something bad was coming.
Right.
Maybe some impending doom.
Yeah, and without any written records, we're left guessing.
I know. Did they migrate somewhere else? Were they wiped out by some natural disaster? We just don't know.
Some scholars think maybe a sudden climate shift could have made their settlements unsustainable.
Hmm. Like a really bad drought.
Exactly. Something that would have dried up their water sources or maybe changed weather patterns that impacted their crops.
Yeah, that would have been devastating for those communities, especially without the technology to adapt.
Right. They might not have had any other choice but to leave their homes and try to find someplace better.
It's fascinating to think about, you know, are there other lost settlements out there just waiting to be discovered?
Oh, I'm sure there are. That's what's so exciting about archaeology, uncovering these hidden chapters of human history.
It's like we're just scratching the surface.
Okay, let's shift gears a little bit and talk about one of my favorite stories from Genesis. The Tower of Babel.
Oh, a classic.
I always love the humor in it. You know, humanity's trying to build this tower to reach heaven, and God's like, not going to happen.
It's a story that speaks to something very human, that desire to connect, to reach for something bigger than ourselves.
Yeah, but it also highlights the challenges of communication and the consequences of pride and ambition.
For sure. And the setting Babylon, which literally means gate of God, adds this whole other layer of irony to the story.
Right, like they were trying to build their own stairway to heaven.
But instead they created more division and separation.
It's a story that's resonated with people for centuries, and it's still relevant today.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, it makes you think about how language shapes our understanding of the world and how easily communication can break down.
Yeah, and I've always pictured the Tower of Babel as one of those massive ziggurats.
Oh, yeah.
You know, those stepped pyramids with temples on top.
I can see that. A massive structure reaching for the sky.
Exactly. A testament to human ingenuity and ambition.
And remember how we talked about those ancient rulers stamping their names on bricks?
Yeah.
Imagine the builders of the Tower of Babel doing the same thing, trying to leave their mark on the world.
It's like that desire to create something that will outlast us.
A legacy.
It's a timeless human impulse, isn't it?
Definitely.
Okay, let's take a little detour from the Tower of Babel and talk about another powerful symbol, the rainbow.
All right.
In the biblical flood account, the rainbow represents God's covenant with humanity, a promise that he won't destroy the world with a flood again.
Right.
But rainbows have had significance in other ancient cultures as well, haven't they?
Oh, yeah. In ancient Mesopotamia, for instance, the bow played a big role in covenant ceremonies, often pointing towards the more powerful party.
So it's like a visual representation of God's authority in that covenant.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It reinforces the idea that the rainbow is a symbol of God's promise and commitment to humanity.
I love how these ancient symbols can hold such deep meaning and still resonate with us today.
Me too.
It's
like they tap into something primal within us.
Now, I know we talked about this earlier, but I want to go back to the question of the flood's timeline.
Okay.
It's just hard to wrap my head around, you know, these ancient events and their place in history.
Mm.
Can we really say for sure when the flood might have happened?
Honestly, dating prehistoric events is incredibly difficult.
Yeah.
It's like trying to piece together a puzzle with half the pieces missing.
Right.
We have archaeological evidence, geological data, textual analysis, but even with all that, we're often left with more questions than answers.
So can we at least narrow it down to a likely time frame?
Well, as we discussed, one theory is that the flood occurred sometime during the Neolithic period before 4300 BC.
Right.
That's based on the fact that many Neolithic settlements seem to have been abandoned around that time, and then new cultures emerged afterward.
Like the flood was a catalyst for change.
Exactly. But it's important to remember that this is just one theory, and there's some problems with it.
Like
Well, for one thing, we haven't found a single globally consistent flood layer in the geological record.
You'd think if it was a global event as described in the Bible, we'd find evidence of it everywhere.
Right, but the geological record is complex, and things get shifted and eroded over time.
So it's possible the evidence is out there, but we just haven't found it yet.
Exactly.
Or maybe the flood was more localized than we think.
It's certainly possible.
This is so interesting. Okay, so the flood's timeline is still up for debate.
Yeah, probably always will be.
But that's okay. That's what makes this stuff so fascinating.
It's all about exploring the possibilities and keeping an open mind.
Now, before we wrap up this section, I want to talk about the idea of pre-flood civilizations.
Okay.
We've been focusing on the biblical narrative, but I'm curious about what other ancient cultures had to say about the time before the flood.
It's important to remember that the Bible isn't our only source of information about the distant past.
Wow.
Many ancient cultures had their own myths, legends, and historical accounts that might offer different perspectives on those early periods.
So what do some of those other cultures say about the pre-flood world?
Well, for example, the ancient Greeks had stories about a golden age, a time of peace and prosperity that was eventually destroyed by human folly.
Interesting.
Similarly, the Hindus have ancient texts that describe cycles of creation and destruction with vast periods of time separating those cycles.
It's amazing how these ideas of a lost golden age or a pre-flood civilization appear in cultures all over the world.
It makes you wonder if there's some kernel of truth to these stories, some shared memory of a time that's been lost to history.
Or maybe it just speaks to a universal human fascination with the past and a longing for a simpler time.
Possible, too.
It's all incredibly fascinating.
It really is. And it just shows how much we still have to learn about our past.
Okay, well, that's some seriously thought-provoking stuff. I'm definitely going to have to do some more research on all of this.
Me too.
But for now, I think we need to take a little break and come back to finish up this incredible deep dive into biblical archaeology and primeval history. All right, we are back and ready to wrap up this deep dive into biblical archaeology and primeval history.
Yeah, it's been quite a journey.
It really has. We've talked about so much. The fall, the Garden of Eden, Noah's Ark, the Tower of Babel, those super long lifespans and those ancient texts, and even those mysterious abandoned settlements from the Chalcolithic period.
It's amazing how all those pieces start to fit together.
Yeah, like a giant puzzle.
When you start looking at it through archaeology and ancient history.
Exactly. So I want to circle back to something we talked about earlier.
Okay.
That Sumerian cylinder seal that seems to depict the fall of man.
Oh, yeah, that one's really interesting.
Yeah, it really is. It predates the traditional timeline for Adam and Eve, but there it is.
It is.
This visual representation of this foundational story.
Right, and from a culture that's totally separate from the ancient Israelites.
It's like we're seeing the same story, but through a different lens.
Exactly. And it makes you wonder about the origins of these stories, you know, how they spread, how they evolved over time.
Yeah. Did they all come from a single source, or did they develop independently in different cultures?
Those are some big questions. And honestly, I don't know if we'll ever have the answers.
Right. But that's part of what makes this stuff so fascinating.
It is. It's the mystery, the unknown that keeps us searching and exploring.
It's all about the journey.
For sure.
And I think that's something our listeners can take away from this. This deep dive is just the beginning. You know, it's an invitation to go out and learn more, to do your own research, and to come to your own conclusions.
Yes. Don't just take our word for it. Go out and explore.
But before we let you go, I want to touch on one more thing that's been kind of a recurring theme throughout our conversation. Symbolism.
Okay.
We talked about the symbolism of the rainbow in the flood account, the tree in the Garden of Eden, even the Tower of Babel itself.
Yeah, those symbols are powerful.
They are. So why do they resonate with us so strongly? Why are they so important?
Well, I think symbols are a way of communicating complex ideas in a simple and memorable way.
It's like a shortcut to a deeper meaning.
Right. And they also tap into something primal within us, something that connects us to these universal human experiences.
Like life and death, creation and destruction.
Exactly. Things that have resonated with people for thousands of years.
And I think that's why these ancient stories, with their rich symbolism, they still have so much power today. They're not just historical accounts. They're reflections on the human condition.
They're stories that help us make sense of the world and our place in it.
That's a great way to put it. So as we wrap up this deep dive, I want to leave our listeners with a thought.
Right.
What are the stories that you carry with you? What symbols hold meaning for you? And how do those stories shape your understanding of yourself and the world around you?
That's a great question to ponder.
It is. It reminds us that we're all part of a larger narrative, a story that connects us to the past, present, and future.
And exploring those connections can be incredibly rewarding.
It really can. So thank you for joining us on this journey.
Thanks for having me.
And thank you to all our listeners for tuning in to The Deep Dive. We'll see you next time for another adventure into the unknown.